We're getting ready to start. You guys ever tried to push a rope? Doesn't work. Kind of like herding cats. It's like being on the end of your leash if you're a dog user and trying to push the dog with the leash. It doesn't work. Anyway, now that I've got your attention, I'd like to introduce our next panel, Courtney Cole, who is going to do a presentation in Rooted in Rights.
Oh, thank you for the warm welcome. So when Heather initially asked me to do this, I said, well, of course I can do this. I love talking about myself. And then last night I said, I don't know if I want to talk about myself. So I made myself a motivational cover page here, and it says, you can do it. So thank you, guys. Today we'll be I'm going to be real open with you guys today, and we'll be discussing a little bit of heavy stuff, including some mental illness and suicide today. So please feel free to leave or take a break if you need to. I won't be offended because I won't be able to see you. As Andy introduced me, my name is Courtney. I am here to impart upon you my 21-year-old wisdom. So, I am pretty average. I know that doesn't seem like a strong opener, but bear with me. I haven't climbed Mount Everest, and I'm not the first blind pilot. I'm not saying these things to be humble or to belittle myself, but ironically, I think the fact that I lead an average life is what makes my story important. So today, I want to take you guys through an abbreviated version of my journey, which moves from understanding to acceptance, and then into advocacy. I'm going to start where most good and even bad stories start, at the beginning. When I was 2 years old, my mom rushed me to the hospital because of a hair tie. It's true. Let me explain. It was a normal day. My saint of a grandpa was allowing little toddler me to do his hair, which basically consisted of me trying unsuccessfully to put his hair into braids and pigtails, both of which it was much too short for. Inevitably, I ended up dropping one of the hair ties. It was blue. The carpet was blue. This was a problem. My parents and grandpa watched in concern as my chubby little hands struggled to find what they could all plainly see. Long story short, it turned out that I have a genetic condition called glaucoma. I was born with it, but doctors didn't discover it until I was 2 years into my life, which means that basically 2 years of damage was done to my optic nerves before I started receiving treatment. You're likely wondering at this point why I'm telling you my life story when the title of this segment is called Likes, Camera, Action. Let's tell our story through video. I'm getting there, I promise. So here I was, 2 years old, already got problems. Having been given faulty genes by my parents, I was pretty annoyed with them, to say the least. Post-diagnosis and before the age of 5, I had at least 15 and likely more procedures. I've now racked up a total of somewhere over 30 surgeries. You guys are probably, many of you, familiar with that experience. They call me a frequent flyer at the hospital, but now that I'm older, I realize how extremely privileged I am to have had such excellent medical care. Without it, I would not have the remaining vision that I do today. And although I no longer fear blindness as I did when I was younger, because I see so many like people here who are completely, extremely successful and totally blind, I still appreciate the visual experiences that I've been able to have because of the vision that has been preserved. Though my early childhood was a struggle medically, I would see more adversity, I would say, during my adolescence. It became much clearer to myself and other students that I was, quote-unquote, different in middle school. My elementary school best friend abandoned me for cool friends. in the beginning of sixth grade, and I found myself alone much of the time throughout middle school. It was during this period that I also started experiencing symptoms of mental illness, which, unbeknownst to me then, would be a part of the rest of my life. I think the reason I struggled so much socially in middle and high school is that I didn't accept myself, and like many teens, had no idea who I was to begin with. But I had much more difference to deal with than most other students. As hard as I tried to hide it, I don't think I was very successful. I also didn't know how to stand up for myself. I remember a particular incident in ninth grade that has stuck with me all these years. I had an accommodation that allowed me to leave class 5 minutes early to get to the next class. And at the time, I didn't use my cane. One morning, I was walking through the foyer of the school when a big, gruff ROTC teacher barked at me. "Where are you going?" he yelled. I tried to stammer out an explanation, but before I could, he yelled at me again, "Get back in the cafeteria." I could feel myself getting upset as I ran to the bathroom as fast as I could. I remember later feeling so ashamed that I wasn't able to stand up for myself. I look back now, and I'm able to marvel at the transformation that has occurred within me over the past 6 years. In the past 2 years, I've learned a lot about video editing and the disability rights movement. All of my video experience has come from my work at Rooted in Rights, a disability advocacy nonprofit based here in Seattle, which focuses on video and other digital media. I could probably say that phrase in my sleep at this point. I've done an extensive amount of work on audio description for our videos and our documentary, Bottom Dollars. My organization was awarded an ACB Audio Description Award for 2018. Yes! Yes. And though the award was for our organization, myself and my coworker Peter Rand focus on most of the description and work extremely hard to make them exceptional. This award being given to Rooted in Rights has made me so proud and reminded me how important it is to make media that is accessible for everyone. This is something that I want to be dedicated to for the rest of my career. So far, I have directed 2 videos and been involved in many, many more. One of the works I am proudest of for Rooted in Rights is a blog article in which I discuss my personal experience with mental illness and suicidal ideation, and the stigma that surrounds suicide and mental illness in general in our society today. Learning how to tell my story has been imperative in not only accepting, but embracing myself and my disability. Through telling my story, I've learned how I view myself, how I want to be viewed, and what kinds of changes that I want to see in the world. In August 2016, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And although this was difficult to deal with and still is today, it has given me the opportunity to tell a new story and to reach out to others who are having the same experience. That's a good lead-in to another point I want to make. Another skill I've gained, arguably even more important than the ability to tell my own story, is the ability to help others tell their stories. This is important not because there's always someone who has it worse. I hate that phrase, because everyone's experience is personal to them and has meaning. It's important to help others tell their stories because there's power in numbers. And though an issue someone wants to talk about may never impact me, helping them tell their story and get it out there builds community. We know a lot about community here because that's one of the things that's most wonderful about this conference and this organization. Helping someone tell their story can be as simple as sharing an article written by another person with a disability on Facebook. As people with disabilities, we have to fight battles constantly, and battles are best fought with an army. Having connection to the blindness and disability community at large has been beyond valuable to me. So I'd like to do a quick activity, so if everyone could wake up if you're taking a nap. So I'd like to ask for 3 volunteers to name 1 place they have faced inaccessibility or discrimination. For example, my home, although I don't think that would be a common example, which is why I picked it. And if you can relate to the place that that person says, I want you to clap, okay? So College. Any? College. Another? Someone? What was that?
Transit Center.
And one more. Work?
Work.
So I'm sure that there are so many more examples you guys can think of. And I'm sure there's more than one of you in the room who can relate to that same thing, right? So the purpose of this little exercise was to show that, as you can see, and as you may have already known, we all face a lot of the same difficulty. So this is why telling stories is so important when it comes to advocacy. Because nothing is going to change if we don't speak up. Even though it makes people uncomfortable when I talk about my experience with suicidal ideation and bipolar disorder, I keep doing it because people aren't going to stop putting people with mental illness down if nobody talks about it. I look back at the timid high school freshman that I used to be, and I'm so grateful that I have come to be bolder. I call myself an advocate and an activist for disability rights, and I'm proud to do so. But my story today is not told so that you'll be impressed with me. Remember in the beginning when I said my story was important because I'm average? I know that was a long time ago, but here's why. The truth is, there are so many ways to advocate and tell stories, and anyone can do it. I use video often, but I'm also a writer, and occasionally, like today, a speaker. Poetry, visual art, music, and even creating hashtags are all activities that have potential for advocacy. And it doesn't have to be fancy. You can take a video of yourself talking about an issue that matters to you and post it to Facebook. Start a blog. Go to a stand-up poetry night and talk about your blindness. Technology is also useful, and you should learn about it because we today have the opportunity to be connected to more people around the world than ever before. But that doesn't take away the value of in-person advocacy and meeting up together to make art, to speak up, to tell your own story. So my question for you all today is, what story are you going to tell next? Thank you. And I'm not sure how much time we have, but I think we might have time for a couple questions if anyone has questions for me. Tim, you're exempt from this. You're not allowed to ask questions.
Is it Courtney? Is that your name, Courtney?
Yes, that's my name.
Okay. I just want to thank you for your courage.
Thank you, guys.
I've been a mental health worker, and so I know what mental health is all about. And I've had lots of experience with disabled people thinking that they cannot live in this world. There's too much against them, and they don't have the personal strength. And also the families and people that relate to them. You know, a lot of times they feel really helpless because they don't know the condition very well because it's not them that's experiencing it. You know, I spent so much time in mental health, and every person I looked at as a story, and every time they came in, I looked at it as a chapter to their story. So I could put all those stories together for each client. And that was since I'm an English literature major, that was a very helpful thing to do. But it also helped with continuity with these clients and their families. So I just wanted to compliment you for your courage.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate you all being here to listen to me today.
Is this on?
Yes.
Okay. My question for you, Courtney, is regarding you said you were working, or that you have done this Bottom Dollars movie. I made an attempt a couple of weeks ago to buy and purchase and download the Bottom Dollars movie on my computer. And the site is not accessible for buying it. I just want you guys to know that when you try to buy the thing, because you know, it's you know where you have the form to do that, it's not accessible. And that's not right. If you're doing a movie for the blind, you need to make an accessible website.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, and that'll be the first thing I check in on Monday. But thank you for that feedback.
I'm Nancy Lind. And the maraca player, as they say. But my quest, I'm also a motivational speaker and an advocate. I'm also in a wheelchair. Courtney, is that your name?
Yes,
Courtney, I want to meet you.
Well, you absolutely can meet me. I'm here all night and tomorrow. So, yeah, and I have Braille cards so that people can stay in touch with me via email, and I can give out my phone number to people who'd like to stay in touch. Thank you. Except Tim, I don't ever want to see him again.
One more question.
Thank you.
Hi, Courtney. This is Julie. I have a question.
Hi, Julie.
A microphone late. Hi there. Lovely speech. How are you finding going to school and working? I'm just curious because a lot of people say I can't do both. How is that for you?
Yeah. I don't think it's you can't do both. I think it's you shouldn't do both. so I currently, obviously, my job is not just a job to me. I'm very, very fortunate to do work that's meaningful to me at such a young age. I don't work at Starbucks. I get to advocate for people's rights. So I'm also very dedicated to getting my degree. And in addition, I recently took a job freelance blogging for a sustainable hygiene products company. So I guess what I find is that it takes a lot of work and dedication, and you also have to take care of yourself, because if, for example, if I stop going to my mental health appointments, then I'm not going to do well at work or school. So I think, you know, taking care of yourself is one of the most essential parts, and then speaking up for yourself, because if you don't have what you need at school, for example, if you don't have accessible textbooks or things like that, your life is going to be so hard. And so advocating, going and making good relationships with your disability office and with your supervisors at work so that you have accommodations in both places, I think that's essential. And I could talk about that a lot more, but I think that's two of the most important things. Thank you so much.
Was that a great presentation or what? While we get ready for the chapter reports, could I ask Danielle Miller, Luoma Duran, and Scott McCallum to come forward, please? And we'll have chapter reports. Microphone to Kathy, please.
Coming.
Okay, so this is the end of our chapter roundup, and we missed some yesterday, so we'll have time because everybody gets a minute. So we have United Blind Seattle, Peninsula, South Kitsap, we have Beatballs Washington State, Snohomish, and Whatman County. So those are the people. Can you guys all stand? And they'll just pass the mic, and we'll do our little chapter roundup. The first one is going to be Andy Bacon with Beatball Clubs of Washington State.
All righty. My name is Andy Bacon. I'm the president of Beatball Clubs of Washington State. And our goal is to get blind individuals up and participating in physical activities. We currently have three teams participating in the Beatball Clubs of Washington State. They are the Wenatchee Blind Bats, Spokane Lions Pride, and Tacoma Tide. Currently, in the past year, the Wenatchee Blind Bats are kind of rebuilding their team. They lost their coach, so they didn't really have a lot going on to report on. Spokane Lions Pride, teaming up with Sports for the Blind. Last year, they went hiking, snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, played soccer, kickball, went rafting, and bowling. They also had several blind awareness games where they partnered with companies out there and had them play, you know, put the sleep shades on and play baseball with them to give them an idea of what it's like to play baseball blind. Going forward this year, the Spokane Lions Pride are going to do the same events. They have also connected with the Spokane School District and identified 60 blind youths in that area. I know it's huge. That's the most exciting thing they reported to me. And they're going to try to get them involved in playing kickball. And they're also looking to work with blinded vets. They're kicking that program off. The Tacoma Tide in the past year, besides playing baseball, they've bowled. And I'm a part of Tacoma Tide, so I'm going to say we. We got a great opportunity this year. The Puyallup Elks Club donated a field to us. They've given the field to us. It was a tennis court with a 10-foot fence around it and asphalt. We've had donated people come in, tear the fence down, haul it away, bring in large equipment, make the field ready to be planted, and the Elks Club is putting the grass in. All of this was donated. We didn't have to pay a dime for it. It's very awesome. The grass is planted and we're ready for it to, you know, be ready for next year. We also had our first game with the Puyallup Police Department. It was our final game of the season. Going forward, we're starting bowling. We've got a snowshoeing event coming up on June 29th. We're going to have a grand opening on that field, and we hope to have the Puyallup Police Department there to play the game with us. And on July 27th, we're going to Spokane to play them, and they're going to take us rafting. Our biggest thing that we're trying to do, and I want everyone to hear this, we want to get more teams together. So if you are interested in building a team in your area, please find me or go to beatball.org. Our phone numbers are on there, and we will be willing to help you get your team together in your area so that we have more teams to play. One more thing, on June 1st, we're having a jamboree in Ellensburg where all the teams are going to come together along with some other people who are interested in forming teams. Thank you.
Hello. This is Marcia from Snohomish County Council of the Blind.
Speak into microphone, please.
I'm secretary. This year we obtained our 501(c) status. We've been out in the community fundraising. We've been quite successful at selling See's candy bars at grocery stores. And in fact, if we hadn't been at Fred Meyer's in Snohomish, we would have missed meeting a fellow from another 501(c) organization. He read our mission statement and donated $1,000 to help send our members specifically to this convention. Due to our fundraising efforts, we have been able to assist most of our members with either registration and or hotel costs, and in some cases both. Fundraising requires getting out in the community, sharing who we are and what we are about, and to let people know we exist. We have been contacting area eye doctors who have been excited about our resource packet that they can give their newly diagnosed patients that have visual impairments. We have our Facebook page up and running, and we now have our website up and running. We are in the midst of getting a professional email for our organization. We have applied at Fred Meyer's to the rewards program, and that's where you apply to put your 501(c) organization on a list. And if a customer chooses your organization, then their rewards will be donated to you quarterly. Also, we've applied to Amazon Smile, and this program works similar. You list your 501(c), and a percentage of the sale goes to your group if chosen. In October, we had a wonderful training on Stop the Bleed Through Disaster Medicine Project. We were taught how to stop a wound from bleeding. We were taught the difference between arterial bleeding versus vein bleeding by feel. We were taught also how to apply different tourniquets and to pack and dress a wound. We actually made the Edmonds paper. And it was because our group was the pioneer group, we were the first visually impaired group of people to receive this training. We've had a fundraiser coming in November through Mod's Pizza, and we're excited about our December fundraiser at Claim Jumpers. And we're going to have a raffle. We have gone around to local businesses who have donated several products to be raffled off.
Hi. Oops. Wow, this is loud. Good morning. I'm Jim Turry from Whatcom County. We're small but mighty. And one of our main events this year was a fundraiser selling coupon books for local businesses. And next to me was one of the newer members who was our top seller for these coupon books. He is not only blind, but in a wheelchair. And he has accomplished. He's a retired farmer, and he has helped us plan other activities, such as getting us involved in a float in the parade. And so we all had a lot of fun sitting on the hay and playing our musical instruments and getting out into the community. We also have technology classes every month. We go around to different senior centers, and we play Christmas carols, and then we talk to people that are becoming blind about what they can do. And so we're reaching out in the community more and more, and we're glad to be here today. Thank you.
Next.
Is that all?
Coming. JR.
Good morning. This is JR Kennison, Peninsula Council of the Blind. And now our new title, Peninsula Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired. Our new constitution. I am the president, and where our activities. We are in our third year running of Beat Baseball. Next game will be the first Saturday of June. And it is a double hitter game with the Bremerton Police Department playing first inning in a 2-2. The sheriff. Because the sheriff lost last year, and this is a thanks for Kevin Daniels with the Seattle Sluggers and our combined game. Other things that we have, we do have the book club, social groups, and we are thinking of relocating our meeting and adding our social hour to a meeting time. And we are putting out a lot of brochures and flyers on our community and getting a lot of ADA information from our local community. So that's what our chapter has proceeded to do this year.
Morning, everyone. Good morning, everyone. My name is Daryl Roberts. I'm the president of United Blind of Seattle, and I can't figure out how to use this microphone. There we go. This is my last year as president for this chapter.
No.
But the last 4 years have been pretty productive for us. We've increased our membership, including 3 individuals from Japan who have joined our group, and that's pretty amazing. We've dipped our toe in the water of many organizations and efforts over the years, including the Gospel Mission Church, helping out homeless individuals who are blind, a situation which should never come up, by the way. Okay. And well, how come this never happens to anyone else? Let me hold it up this way. How's that? Is that better? No. He doesn't think it's me, and it probably isn't.
Try this one, Daryl.
Hello, is this on? All right, anyway, what was I saying? And yeah, we've picked up 3 new members from Japan, and we're kind of honored about that. They stopped by to visit us and said, hey, yeah, these guys are pretty cool. Let's sign in with them. And I'm really proud of the things that we've done over the last 4 years. I kind of rewarded my chapter by taking them out on a 80-foot yacht to go sailing this summer. So we're also looking forward to getting a Facebook and account up and website. But that's technical stuff way over my head. I leave that to other people, okay? That's it. Thank you.
Thank you for all the chapter roundups. My microphone's on.
Coming.
Hi, my name is Jessamine Lanby, and I'm a member of South Kitsap Council of the Blind. Our members are kind of spread out, so at our meetings we've done a couple different things since it's hard to get together for socials and stuff. One thing that we do is a who's who. So 2 people are picked from the group, and they tell us something that we may not know about them, to get to know our members better in our group. We also started a kind of a hugs thing. We have a gal that wears an apron, and it says hugs on it, and she has candy in the pockets, and she goes around, and she gives you a hug, and then you can have a piece of candy from her if you'd like. And it's just another way to interact with members in our group. We will be starting a new fundraiser. It's with Script gift cards, and so we will be selling gift cards soon. A percentage of each gift card is given to us, and we have 2 ways of doing it. We can physically sell them, or we can do it electronically. And we were doing it because sometimes some of the fundraisers are hard to do or members are uncomfortable selling stuff. And this way we can have money kind of trickling in for things throughout the year. And our last meeting, we kind of did a game day where we had somebody come and bring accessible games and talk about them and show them. And that's what we've done so far in our chapter.
Now my microphone's not on. Need a front mic on?
I still have one. You can try this.
Keep talking. I got the other microphone. Hello? It's still not on. Here it is. Now it's on.
There you go. Okay.
So, we're getting ready for the next panel. We're a couple of minutes late, but I got an announcement to make. If you volunteer to be a mentor for the youth group,
yep.
They're meeting in the Benton Room in about 10 minutes.
What?
So, Beacon Room. Benton, Beacon, I don't know. I washed my tongue this morning and can't do a thing with it. So if you could please migrate to the Beacon Room if you're a mentor. Now for our next panel, I'm going to invite Danielle Miller to the microphone.
Good morning, WCB. I'm so delighted to be here with you and have the opportunity to talk about the library. There's a lot going on, as usual. I'll start with some updates on future happenings with NLS, the National Library Service. Woo is right, exactly. So things coming down the pike with the Digital Talking Book Service. They are going to be working on developing the next generation of the Digital Talking Book Player. I had a couple people in the exhibits ask me yesterday if the current player was going away. The player's not going away, so if you love your player, don't panic. I'm not going to take it away from you. It's yours. Don't worry about it. But the next version of the player, they are thinking will be something small. An idea is that it might be something like a locked-down cell phone that would have wireless access. It would have cellular or internet for NLS, Wotabal, Talking Book and Braille Library content. It would have a voice interface so you could talk to it and ask it for the book you want. It would have easy controls. It would have wireless delivery so that if you're someone who gets your books automatically from us, your books would just show up on your small player. You would also be able to have books pushed to it wirelessly so you could still talk to the reader's advisors and ask for a specific book, and then that book would show up on your device. So I think this is really exciting. Also, the future model for the Digital Talking Book Service is about 80% wireless delivery, 20% by mail, because we know that the mail service is still going to be the way that some people are going to get their books. We're also looking at high usage of personal devices. So people who are already using mobile devices and the Bard app, the Braille and Audio Reading Download, will still be using that. And the Bard is going to be moving to the cloud in the next 12 months or so, which is pretty exciting. They're going to have better searchability, which will be nice. I know I talked to some people about searching. It's going to be more reliable. It's going to be faster, so that's exciting. And also in the next couple of years, they're going to transfer all the Bard content and make it streamable so that another way to be able to use personal devices is that you'll be able to use Bard on things like Amazon Echo. So you'll be able to talk to that and say, I want The Cat Who or whatever book you want to read. So looking at the future of the digital with a small player that you can talk to, with your personal device, or streamable Bard content. So that's all as a package looking at 5 years or so. So stay tuned for more on that. And then on the Braille front, I know there's been a lot of buzz about that, but we're going to make the service equitable for Braille readers as for audio readers by loaning out a refreshable Braille display or a Braille e-reader to all Braille readers in the next couple years. Exactly. I think that's definitely worth applause. So the Braille reader is, NLS has just signed a contract for the production of Braille readers for a pilot. The pilot will be due to start sometime next year. And, of course, you know me, I have begged and said, yes, we want to be one of the pilot libraries. I don't know yet if we will, but keep your fingers crossed for us that we'll be one of the pilot libraries. That pilot will last about 2 years, and it'll cover all aspects from repair, from circulation, from how it works, from tech support. And so with the refreshable Braille displayers, we're calling them Braille e-readers, what people will do is download their Braille books from Bard, or if people don't have access to Bard, because we don't want to leave anybody out, of course, we would send the Braille books to people either on a cartridge or an SD card. We'll see how that manifests once the pilot starts. So that's coming sometime next year. Very exciting. Also, collection development. The collection will be increasing. Over the last couple years, NLS has been developing more relationships with commercial publishers. So that's really increasing our content. Used to be we'd get about 2,000 new audiobooks a year. This past year, it got up to 3,000. In the next year or so, we're going to be closer to 5,000 new audio titles a year. So one thing to think about, we're not getting all of those audio titles in physical copies, so not all of them are coming on cartridge, but every single new book goes on Bard. So those are there. Another thing I want to talk about is that the Braille collection, as you know, has always been smaller in what's getting added, but when we get to go to those refreshable Braille displays, they're not going to be producing hard copy Braille the way they do now. It's going to be primarily an electronic Braille collection. But something on the good side with that is that they'll be able to produce much more Braille because they're not going to be spending the money on embossing it, and they'll be able to turn over that production much more quickly. We also are adding to that collection really a lot at the Talking Book and Braille Library. We've got 9 recording studios right now for audio production, and we're already putting out about 200 new audiobooks a year, which I think is really a significant addition to the collection. We're upgrading our studios, and we're adding 2 more booths, so we'll be up at 11 booths. We've right now got 85 amazing narrators, and with 11 booths, I think we're going to be able to produce even more books, so you can see more great content coming from us. We are also in the process of purchasing a high-end scanner that's going to allow us to scan books and use OCR, optical character recognition, to scan those books into a text file that then we can convert to Braille. So we're going to really be able to increase our Braille production locally at the library, too. So increasing content on both fronts. And I want to thank Tony Stevens for mentioning the Marrakesh Treaty this morning. That's something else that's really exciting that, again, is going to help end that book famine. And what it's going to do is increase access for patrons who read materials in other languages, languages other than English. It's going to increase the access so much. And you can try going to Canada and saying, give me a Braille book. I don't know if that's going to be the best way, but we're going to be the best way to help facilitate getting those books in other languages. And so NLS is working right now with key people to help implement that, and a lot of that will go through the Accessible Book Consortium. So we're getting the logistics worked out. One thing I want to mention, a couple key changes. It's actually the Marrakesh Treaty Implementation Act is what's going into place, and that changes the copyright that allows us to produce our books. And a couple changes that are really great that happened. It expanded the type of works that are allowed from just non-dramatic literary works to all literary works. So that's pretty great. Another change is that it changed the term from specialized formats to accessible formats, which is a broader term for us. And it updated the beneficiaries from blind and other persons with disabilities to eligible persons, to someone who is blind, has a visual impairment, perceptual reading disability, physical disability making them unable to hold a book, manipulate a book, or focus or move their eyes to read. So there's a broader scope of people who are eligible under the copyright law as well. So that's really exciting. Another new thing is that we're able to make BARD accounts for people now. So that has been a hurdle for some people to create their own accounts. We can do it at the library. So as soon as somebody signs up, we can create a BARD account for them. There's also a new firmware update that people can get that will allow them to not have to use the bookshelf mode to move from one book to another. So that's been a hurdle for some people with the player. And another thing that that's going to be great for is that we have a fairly new service called Custom Book Service. That is where we put multiple books on one cartridge, and that cartridge is geared to an individual patron instead of being a specific title. And the reason we're doing that is there are over 85,000 books available on BARD, but only about 40,000 titles in the collection in hard copy. So if someone's not downloading books for whatever reason, they're missing out on about half the collection. And we want to make sure that the service is equitable for everybody and everybody has access. So what we're doing is making that individual cartridge for the specific person. I'm looking at Jessamine. Say Jessamine wanted that service. It'd be her cartridge, so she'd have two cartridges going with all the books that she wanted to make sure she's not missing out. So if you're interested in that service, you can come find me, or if you know somebody who would benefit, making sure they're not missing out on any of the collection. And getting toward the end here, I wanted to let you know we've got a lot of great stuff going on in our youth services department. This year we're going to do two Braille challenges. We're going to do one in Eastern Washington as well, so one in Seattle and one in Spokane. That'll be in February. Another cool thing that we're doing is we're taking on sort of a support or adjunct librarian role to the School for the Blind. So we're going to support that. Yes. So all year long, we're going to take a revolving capsule collection of Braille and audio materials based on students' needs, requests, and preferences down to the school. And so this is our youth services librarian, Erin, who's amazing, is going to be doing this. We're going to provide research guides and lessons on using online databases, how to cite works, and evaluating resources, which especially now in the time of fake news is super important. I'm sure you would all agree. We're going to work with teachers on special projects, finding materials, and helping their lesson planning. We're going to assist on using the media center and technology equipment they have at school so they can have the most robust use of that material. And we're going to assist on organizing their current library collection. And then this last federal fiscal year, so fiscal year 2018, with outreach that we've been doing on the part of our older adult services librarian, youth librarian, outreach that I've been doing, and the NLS outreach campaign that some of you may have heard advertisements on the radio or they've been running on some TV stations. I see some people nodding. It's been a great outreach campaign. We actually have had our highest patron enrollment since I started in 2008 with 1,739 new patrons signing up last year. So it's been a great year. And I appreciate all that you guys do to support the library. Thank you very much.
All right. Hello, everybody. This is Scott McCullum from the school. It's great to be here. Before I get started, I want to recognize some of you in the audience who help us at the school by serving on our board, donating lots of time and effort to help us run a very efficient and, I think, a well-run school. So with that said, I want to recognize both Burl Cawley, sitting right in front here, and Reg George. They both serve on our governor-appointed board. We also have Jolene Ferguson out in the audience there. Jolene serves on our ex officio board representing WCB in all of our board meetings and does an excellent job with that. Well, there's a lot going on at the school, as always. Some good, some it has been a little bit challenging, and I'll get to that. We do still run the Ogden Resource Center. I think we are the largest producer of Braille in the state, and we provide Braille textbooks for students around the state, and also do a ton of Braille for other entities. We actually have worked with the women's prison in Gig Harbor and currently have 21 women who are incarcerated there who are nationally certified Braille transcribers in Nemeth, literary, and music. So that's been a great program. I recently saw a little tweeted out video about that from the prison system. It's great. Our outreach program is growing and growing and growing. It's our largest. It's how we reach the most students in the state. We have a brand new director of outreach. Her name is Pam Parker. Pam Parker is from the east side of the state and is replacing Emily Coleman, who moved on to the Texas School for the Blind and Visually Impaired and is serving as their outreach director. So our outreach program reaches about a quarter of the students in the state and is providing services to students in their local school districts at a level, hopefully, that they need. Also, Dr. Snyder is our Birth to Three coordinator. That program is also continually expanding. We're finding more and more babies out there that don't have or didn't have access to services who are now being served by their local agencies through our partnership with them. We're working with both OSPI, the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, and the Department of Children, Youth, and Families to explore some new methods of service delivery. This state has some interesting systems in place that I believe don't reach all students. And so we're currently in discussions with those two entities, with our partners at the School for the Deaf and the Deaf Blind Project, looking at a new way of serving kids in this state. And so we're exploring regional program service delivery model and other ways of making sure that all kids in the state of Washington have access to appropriate services from appropriately trained personnel. In the transition world, we have some wonderful partners at the Department of Services for the Blind. We work hand in hand with DSB to facilitate our LIFT program. That's our transition program. LIFT stands for Learning Independence for Today and Tomorrow. I've actually approached the governor and submitted a package to build a new transition center on our campus. And I'm hoping that the governor and the legislature supports those efforts because we would like to create a system or a model that really meets the needs of students around the state that are moving into adulthood. So keep your fingers crossed on that. It's about an $8.5 million project. We also partner with DSB to provide a youth transition service specialist. Her name is Marcy Ebarb. There's many others, but Marcy specifically is located on our campus and services students in and around Clark County. That's been very successful so far. On campus, a ton going on. We offer a variety of program options there. We have our residential programs, our day programs, our partial day programs. We now have these short courses with another WCB member who's not here today, I believe, but Jeff Bowler runs that program. He's doing a remarkable job. Those short courses, students come in for a week at a time, and they have a targeted set of skills that they're working on. So I know coming up here is Thanksgiving, and so we will run a cooking program where students come in from around the state. They jump on our buses that we have going up and down I-5, or we fly them in. They live on our campus with our student body. They have extra time for their homework that they're missing while they're in at our school. But their exit project, which is something I really love, is to cook a Thanksgiving dinner. And I really love it because they invite me to test out their cooking. So that's been very successful. We also do our online programs, and then we have summer programs. Currently, we have about 60 students on campus, and I say about because it fluctuates pretty regularly because of those short courses and other programs on campus, and we constantly have students coming in and out. But the on-campus, the ebb and flow is going well right now. We have, I was presenting at the Cosby Institute. It's a leadership institute. It's called the Council of Schools and Services for the Blind. It's where all of us superintendents and principals get together from around the country. And I had the honor of presenting with Dr. Andy Stefik from University of Nevada, Las Vegas, who's a partner with us. And we were presenting on computer science principles for the blind and visually impaired, and I learned that we are the only school in the country right now, at least that was in attendance there, that offers an advanced placement level computer science class for students who are blind or visually impaired. On that note, we're also in a partnership with the University of Washington, UNLV, and a bunch of other partners to advance computer science for the blind and visually impaired. We work specifically with the Quorum language that Leslie Weilbacher mentioned earlier today. Let's see. We also, I mentioned there's some negative things going on. We are not immune, excuse me, to the challenges that many students face. Sorry, this is like really immediate right now. We're not immune to the challenge that people face around school safety and issues with violence and all of those kinds of things. We have not had a specific issue on campus with where student safety is jeopardized, but we have been targeted by some online anonymous person who is targeting staff and students with what started out as threatening, discriminating language and has increased to threats. We are working with law enforcement. One of our students was here earlier, so... One of the great things I learned about being a government agency is when local law enforcement didn't take me seriously that this was happening, I called the governor's office. And the governor's office takes me really seriously when I call and say somebody is sending us these messages. And so within a minute of that conversation with the governor's deputy chief of staff, I was on the phone with Chief Batista from Washington State Patrol. So, yes. Washington State Patrol got involved and offered support to VPD, Vancouver Police Department, and now we're getting all kinds of support. So it's one of those instances where I wasn't sure how we fit into state government all the time, and this is a moment where I'm extremely thankful that we are and that I have that direct line to the governor's office because they made stuff happen. I spent all day yesterday with three different detectives. They are working on this. I can't get into all of the details because it is an ongoing investigation, but we're getting close, and our ultimate goal, as all of you know, is to keep our students safe, and we will do that. While I do believe our students are safe at the moment, I am concerned about their social and emotional health, and that extends to staff. Including myself. Yeah. On a more positive side, so I don't cry to you all.
Shows the human side of your skin.
Well, thanks. On a much more positive side, our goalball team right now is at the Youth Goalball National Tournament in Florida. We have two teams there. I'm hoping our boys and girls are both doing very well. In the coming weeks here, our powerlifting team will be heading to the World Powerlifting Championships in Las Vegas. 2 years ago when we sent our powerlifting team, we had 5 students set world records in powerlifting. As an agency, I was listening to Jeff talk earlier about the importance of mentoring. We are working with OSPI. And the Washington Sensory Disability Services to address the shortage of teachers that we have in the state. And so OSPI, through WSDS, has provided funding to train teachers at no charge to the individual, and it's picked up by the state. And we're providing mentorship, so I've hired a mentor. It used to be Pam Parker, who has now moved into my our outreach director role, and now we just hired Joe DeLugo to take on that role of mentorship so that we can support our new teachers out there. Teachers who are in that program are going to the university, both Portland State University and Stephen F. Austin University in Texas. It's a predominantly online program, but wherever these new teachers are in the state, we're making sure that they have the support to successfully serve the students that we work with. And also, this is really exciting for me. Last year, we partnered with WATEC. It's another government agency to produce a video, a film about our school, because I believe there is a magic that happens when students are on our campus. There's just something really special that I see this this wonderful shift in how they feel about themselves, how they feel about others, and they really form this wonderful community. It reminds me of being here in so many ways. And I wanted to capture that magic, so we worked with WATEC to create a film about our school. And I told the filmmaker, one of the things we need to do is we need to embed audio description. So we started working with Dr. Joel Snyder. You may be familiar with him. we worked a little bit with Dr. Snyder and then our folks at WATEC to embed this audio description as a natural part of the video and not have it as an add-on. And so I'd like you to check out that video. It's on our school website. It's called I Love My School. It's also linked on our Facebook account. We blasted it out through Twitter, and I'll send it out to you if you like. But it's fully audio described. It's got closed captioning on there. And it really does a nice job of sort of highlighting what is really, really special about our specialized school environment. So check it out. I'd love to get feedback on it. I think it turned out really well. I'll tell you that the story that it sort of evolves around is just, it's about a parent letter that we received about a month before we went into filmmaking. It wasn't our plan to do it that way, but it just evolved that way organically. And so it's a true story, and it features those actual student and that actual parent in addition to all of our other students. And they tell you or tell all of us about what they like about being at the Washington State School for the Blind. So please check that out. Thank you. Larry is just acknowledged. It's a great video, so check it out. And then finally, I'm happy to answer any questions at the end of this. It's really wonderful to be here. I know my time is running out, but Luoma is next. So thank you very much, folks.
Hi, everybody. It is great to be back with this organization. This room is packed. I don't know how many people are in here, but this is a huge room, and it is jam-packed. I've really appreciated so far today the emphasis on telling our stories. And one of the things that I love about WCB is how inclusive it is. And looking around this room, there are so many different kinds of stories in this room to be told. And another thing that I love about this organization is the emphasis on fun. You guys are a fun crowd to be with. I'm pleased that we have a number of our staff from DSB here today. I won't name them all, but there are quite a few folks here, plus OTC students, plus a number of our youth. So if you don't know, and our SRC members as well. So if you don't know these folks, I hope you will get a chance to meet us while you're at the convention. I'm going to start out with the good news. This past federal fiscal year, which ended in September, we had 157 of our customers complete their rehab programs and go to work in good jobs with benefits. The average wage was around $23.50 an hour, and every year we publish a list of the jobs and the employers on our website just to give you a flavor for the range. It's quite a range of jobs. And just to give you a little taste, we had folks go into medical records and health information technicians, technician types of jobs. We had clinical psychologists, some lawyers, some folks in adult literacy and remedial education, receptionists, information clerks, business intelligence analysts, whatever those are, I don't know, human resources managers, mental health counselors, health technologists and technicians. We had medical and clinical laboratory technicians. We had folks in computer systems jobs. We had animal caretakers, mechanical engineers, appraisers and assessors. The oldest person we had go to work in competitive employment was an 81-year-old person who went to work successfully as a real estate assessor. And we had a 21-year-old at the other age, end of the age spectrum, going to work as a teacher assistant. And we had 10 people going to work in self-employment and small business startups. So when you get a chance, check out our website. Take a look at that list. I think it's really exciting. Another big piece of good news is in our youth programs. And Scott, thank you for highlighting the things that we do together. The school is such a fabulous collaborator with us to serve youth. I'll mention a few other aspects of our youth programs. Because of we're the only blind agency in the nation, actually, that starts to serve young people at the age of 9 years old with our vocational rehabilitation pre-employment services transition program, which is really exciting, and we have really expanded those services around the state. Starting at age 9, and now we have things going on all over the state. We have skills workshops, which focus on the 9 to 13-year-olds, and they do all kinds of sort of fun recreational things, but also that kind of combine the recreation with learning interpersonal skills, being exposed to different kinds of employment. This year we had skills programs in Eastern Washington, Mount Vernon, Seattle. They do also some activities of daily living, things like cooking, budgeting, grocery shopping. We had another group in Olympia. Then we piloted what we're calling our LEAP program, Life Skills Extended Assistance Program, and that's for young people who need maybe some more additional supports. That's age 14 through 21. We had things going on in Puyallup, Pierce County. We had a day camp. Then back with the School for the Blind, we had our Yes One program where students did mock interviews and they did career inventory assessments. In our Bridge program, that's helping students bridge their transition from high school to college. We had students living on campus and then also helping out with our skills program with the younger students. And then we also now have a program called SWAG where students take college courses and also work part-time at the same time. So, and then you've heard a lot before, I think, about our Yes 2 program at the University of Washington, where students work and get and have paid employment and live on campus. So, lots of good things happening. One of the reasons why we've been able to expand our youth programs is that we have had the federal set-aside program to spend 15% of our, excuse my, I'm losing my voice today, but 15% of our vocational rehabilitation funding on pre-employment transition services. That's the upside, and we have really appreciated being able to develop more robust programs. The downside of that is that that actually reduced our adult vocational rehabilitation services funding by 15% per year. So that, in effect, created about a $1.4 million cut to our funding for adult vocational rehabilitation services per year. That started in 2015. We were able to kind of stay on course because we had some cushion in terms of federal carryover dollars and some things. So we were able to not feel the impact too much until this year. Now we are feeling the impact. And most of you may already know that as of October the 1st, we had to implement what is called an order of selection. And that's federal legislative language because the feds prescribe if we don't have enough resources to serve everybody at a certain moment in time, we have to establish a way of prioritizing who gets served. And in effect, it creates a waiting list so that if we don't have enough resources, some people go onto the waiting list. And there's a very particular way that we go about establishing those priorities. We've had public meetings. We've had input from our rehab council. We have had to go through changes in our Washington administrative code. It's kind of complicated. But right now, the bottom line is that if someone is in one of our active plans for employment, they are receiving the full range of services, no change, no diminishing to their services at all. Also, anyone can apply for services, and we encourage people to apply because that gets you sort of in line, even if you even if you end up on the waiting list with a delay, you're lined up. So we encourage people to apply. When you do apply, we will do an eligibility assessment, and we will do as much as we can to help you get hooked up with whatever resources are available in the community or through the workforce partners that we collaborate with, just to get whatever kind of information and other resources might be available. And, of course, we always talk about the consumer groups and how important you guys are in terms of supports and just networking and information out in the communities. You're really key to helping people stay on track and know what's possible. So right now I think we have about 24 people who are waiting for services. The point of order of selection is the intention of the legislation is that the people who need services the most are the ones who will get services first or the most quickly. And the language in the law around that is functional limitations. It's not about the type of disability. And so, for example, functional limitation might be that you need technology, you don't have any, you haven't had computer training, or you might need orientation and mobility training in order to travel, or you might need some sort of assistance around managing one of your other disabilities like diabetes or that sort of thing. So just because you have a disability, like you, for example, you might be totally blind, but you might already have great orientation and mobility skills. You might already have an academic degree. You might already have a lot of technology skills. So you might not go to the top of the list. You might have to wait if you needed other kinds of services. So that's vocational rehabilitation and where we are right now with order of selection. So this brings me to our other major program, which is independent living. That's both the older blind program and younger blind program in independent living. And so for the past, 10, 15 years, those programs have been flat funded at the federal level in terms of the federal grants and the state match. They haven't seen increases. At Services for the Blind, we've had the ability and the luxury of being able to commit additional resources through, sometimes we've had some extra state money or other additional money that we've been able to supplement the basic federal grants. Well, now because of just the tightness of the circumstances in all aspects of the state funding budget and the flat funding at the federal level, right now all we have for independent living resources are basically the federal grants and the state match. We were just able to add some extra money through some local funds that became available just this last month, but not a huge amount. But anyway, we're working with the providers around the state. We have convened two work groups of providers and consumers and staff to think about what are we going to do for independent living in the short term and what can we do in the long term? Short-term strategies, long-term strategies. So the group that's working on the short term has convened. The long-term strategy group has not yet convened. But we've had participation, though, also from Aging and Adult Services, which they've been helpful in educating us on how providers can tap into Medicaid and Medicare funding for some equipment services and also some independent living services. Some of our providers are going to take advantage of that. It is onerous, though. There's a lot of paperwork. Probably the smaller providers won't be able to do much of that. However, the Aging and Adult Services folks have been really helpful. They're hooking us up with local, what are called the AAA, local resource people, and in the various communities. So there's a lot going on. The second group, the longer term strategy group, goes back to kind of the theme that we were talking about earlier, is telling the story. This group is going to work on, okay, what kind of data do we
not have that we really need to make the case compellingly to funding sources, to the legislature, et cetera. How do we go about telling the story about independent living? DSB has submitted two budget proposals for this coming biennial budget, one for vocational rehabilitation and one for independent living, requesting funding. Those are in the hands of the governor's office right now. We won't know until December whether the governor will include our proposals in the governor's budget. Of course, that would still have to go through the legislature, but we are working with legislative staff, or we have been for months, and also the governor's staff on these two budget proposals and making the case for them. In independent living this last year, 2018, we served about 1,785 customers. In vocational rehabilitation, I think we served about 1,274. So that's about 3,060 customers across the state in those two programs. So that's a significant constituency. So the picture in the state, the budget climate is not good. I'm in the governor's cabinet, and like Scott, and one of the things we've been told is that even the governor has a strategic plan, but even he doesn't have funding for his strategic priorities. He has to make the case for either increased taxes or other things have to be cut. So there's just not any new money. Either there has to be new taxes or some cuts somewhere else. And so most agencies don't even have enough to maintain their current level of service in these circumstances. So that's kind of the grimmer side of the picture. So anyway, thank you. Are you going to do questions?
I'd like to open it up for questions.
Debbie Phillips, United Blind of Spokane, Gadoos. Danielle, will the Braille e-reader be also connected for those of folks who have subscriptions to Bookshare? Will we be able to download from there as well?
Hi, Debbie. I would think so, because it's going to have a slot for an SD card and a USB. So I would think you would be, if you can take a book from Bookshare and put it on there, it should work. It's going to be 20 cell. I would think so. Does that help? Yep. So I don't see why not, but I don't see why you couldn't use third-party content on the device. But I guess don't quote me on that. But I would think it should be fine.
Hi, my question's for Luoma. By the way, thanks for being here. You're always so informative, and thanks again for that. So does income play a level in order of selection? And what about previous amount of services someone's already received?
Income does not play any role, no. Eligibility works the way it always has, eligibility for services. So we will make people eligible in just the same way. What happens after you're made eligible is then we will constantly be analyzing or trying to project how many people we can afford to bring off the waiting list. And what was the second part of your question?
So if I've already received services year after year after year after year, am I still eligible potentially for additional services?
Like I said, eligibility isn't changing. It's okay. Just the same as it always has been.
Okay.
The thing that's different is that you might have to wait if... Oh, well, if it depends on the functional limitations.
Okay, great.
Yeah, you need to have significant need, which means you really need our services. You need several... significant services. I forgot to mention that we do have an exception for people who have functional limitations who are, I shouldn't even use the word exception, it's a little too technical, but for people who are in a job and have functional limitations and need our services to retain their job, they're a priority. They would be a priority. So.
Okay. This is Mark Adrian, and I have two questions, one for Danielle, one for the Woma. The Woma, just want to talk about the environment at large as well, because, again, not only is DSB in order of selection, so is the general agency in order of selection, so VR in the state of Washington is completely in order of selection. However, would you address how we are now part of the workforce system conversations, and they are stepping up to provide services to our customers better than they've ever done before? And Danielle, in conjunction with that, you might want to share with the group how you're now a center for the workforce, an affiliate or whatever, for workforce.
Right. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with WorkSource centers around the state, but we, Mark Adrian, Michael McKillop, and I, and others, counselors, people in local areas, are in constant conversation with the works folks who are in the WorkSource centers, providing a whole range of things, everything from assistance with trying to figure out housing to job readiness, job readiness training opportunities. Mark Adrian could probably recite more of the services off the top of his head than I can, but just a whole range of services that people can benefit from if the customer depending on the level of access at the local WorkSource center. But we are advocating for that in our local areas, and we can help hook people up and do the warm handshake and so on and help you get familiar with what's available in your area. The harder thing for our customers is going to be around adaptive skills training, if somebody needs adaptive skills training, because we do so much of that with our own staff in-house. There aren't as many resources around the state for that. But we are going to try to do some creative things, maybe some more group services. We were talking about having open houses once a month at the agency where we would let just anybody come in. It wouldn't matter what program they were involved in or not. Just anybody from the public could come in and have some hands-on exposure to technology. They might get some exposure to some adaptive skills techniques and so on. So more to come about that.
Thank you for the plug, Mark. I should have mentioned that. There's always so little time. So Watabo is now officially a WorkSource connection site. So we can support you in your job search or connecting with WorkSource. If you can come in physically to the library, you can work in our computer lab. So you can use the assistive technology on our PC or use our Mac to access the WorkSource site. We can help support you in creating a resume or working on a cover letter in your job search. So really, we don't have all of the services, but can help connect you to the service and help connect you in your search. And we're going to look at partnering on having some trainings at the library in the future. And we can, since you're not all of you able to come into the library in Seattle, we can try and help you with some support over the telephone as well. But primarily, we're looking at those supports like helping you in your search, looking at what's available in your area, using some of the WorkSource tools, and helping in the resume building for right now. So we are technically a connection site, so that's an exciting new development at the library. Thanks, Mark.
This is Sarah Edick, and I have a comment for LaWoma and a question for Danielle. My comment for LaWoma is I'm in a position right now where I can actually be of assistance getting help with this new program that Aging and Adult Services has. It's called New Freedom. It's in King and Pierce County, and I'd like to see the program go statewide. The program's already contracted with Access Technology with Al Yardley, as well as with Site Connections and other blind organizations. and people that sell blind products. So if there's anything that I can do to help you guys get more connected, I've got contacts. Also, Danielle, there's been a question going around Facebook. I don't know if you've heard it, but what's the deal with all the public narrators? What happened to all the narrators at NLS? And are they still reading books? And my other question is, my concern about that is, like, we don't get some of the descriptive stuff like we used to get on, like, okay, when Laura Gianarelli read the Mrs. Murphy mysteries, she would say, signed with a paw print, Sneaky Pie. Well, Kate Forbes says, Sneaky Pie.
Gosh, Sarah, I don't know. I'm just going to be honest with you. I don't know. I'm going to have to do some research into this for you. It could be the text in the book. I don't know. I'm going to have to do some investigation. Okay.
I had a quick question for Danielle. I heard that they're not going to have any large print books at the library any longer. Is that true? And I can see why they probably wouldn't, but are there other places people can go to get check out large print books at all, or is that pretty much over?
That is true, Becky. We stopped circulating our adult large print collection at the end of August. We hadn't had a budget for large print, actually, since 2009, so the collection had really been deteriorating. The condition was poor. There was nothing new, so it wasn't getting refreshed. Our large print circulation was very small, and so for many of the readers, they had really read out the books that were of interest to them. And it was really kind of time to rip that Band-Aid off. And a lot of readers, those that were able, were using things like tablets and e-readers, able to enlarge the font, that kind of thing. And we talked to a lot of people about it. We took the issue to our Patron Advisory Council, and they put forward a resolution that it was, in fact, time to eliminate the adult large print collection. We kept the youth, the teen and young adult and child, the juvenile collection, so that's still available. But actually, every public library in the state has a large print collection. So if you're able to access your public library, you'll be able to access large print, and they refresh their collection, they get new books. And many of the public library systems have outreach departments or mobile services. So you may, if you live near a public library that has that, you may be eligible for their outreach services. And some of them have by mail programs or visit certain areas by mobile services. So if you need help with that, you're welcome to call me, and I can try and help put you in touch with your public library.
That'll be all the questions. We don't have time for any more. I would like to give a round of applause for our presenters. We have time for a door prize.
And then I have some announcements. All right. So, who's hungry? All right. This is a cool door prize, you guys. I'm going to give away this trinket that Dan Lovell has made. It's really a cool looking sort of round cylindrical thing, and it's got it, like, you know, you could put like a something small in there, some new change maybe. And we're going to give away from the Yakima Valley Council of the Blind $500,000 in candy and $20 in cash. What that means is that there are 500 grand bars.
Whoa!
So you can carry that with you to the to the banquet room. All right, and our winner is Carrie Bailey. Not here. All right. Tony Stevens, are you in the room?
Oh no.
Oh. All right.
Didn't call my name.
Working on it.
Good.
Kathy Watkinson.
She cannot accept it.
Okay.
Oh, Siobhan Cotel, are you in the room? Is she here? All right. All right. One of my Wetabla patrons.
Yeah, with David. Yeah, 1 second.
All right. I have several announcements. Listen up, or you're going to have to stay here, and you won't get any lunch. You haven't had an opportunity yet, or you have still have additional questions. Ira is still here to talk to you and sign you up and do all that good stuff. I don't know where she is, but oh, okay. See Deb. And of course, if you sign up, you got to give me your points. You know, no. Debbie and I are going to fight over them. All right. The hotel has requested that we try to leave by sections so that we don't have a whole line out by the elevator. So when we break, if the mic runners could kind of help go over and let individual sections of the room know that they can leave, it will be easier for the elevator. Yeah, we're going to do order of selection. That's right. We want you to know what it's really like. The guide dog users lunch and program is in Magnolia, where you were this morning. The general lunch is upstairs in the summit room. We will be starting again at 1:30 sharp because we have a lot of things we have to get through this afternoon. So if you want to be in here and you want to be able to vote, then you need to be here by 1:30. Make sure you have the right color dot on your name tag to be able to vote. And what color is that dot? Green. If you don't have a green dot, well, too bad. And I think that's all the announcements I have for right now. So we will break until 1:30.
Yeah.
Oh, one more thing. We still have MMS forms. That's the monetary monthly support forms. We are going to give away a prize to someone who has signed up for the first time. So we still have those for you to fill out. And they are on the registration. Well, the registration table is closed.